Hello and welcome. This is Lori Nicholson with Joyful Birth Hypnobirthing, and I'm happy to share this presentation with you, Baby's Birth Plan, a review of the research on pregnancy and birth. A short disclaimer before we get started here. I am not a medical care provider. I'm a childbirth educator and a researcher by training, so nothing in this presentation should be construed as medical advice. Please seek medical care from your care provider. This presentation is informational in nature only. We'll be taking a look at the medical model versus the physiological model of birthing. The medical model looks at pregnancy as a pathology, and it includes potentially invasive interventions, including unnecessary routine interventions in low-risk situations, whereas the physiological model involves trusting in nature's way of birthing. There's more of a hands-off, loving support for the mom, baby, and partner. Which one is best supported by evidence-based research? Evidence-based medicine is generally defined as individual clinical expertise coupled with best external evidence merged with, very importantly, patient values and expectations. Why isn't evidence-based care standard practice? One study found that care providers do not follow clinical practice guidelines due to lack of awareness or familiarity with the evidence, lack of agreement with what the guidelines recommend, lack of self-efficacy, in other words, they don't trust their ability to change, lack of positive expectancy, in other words, they don't expect a positive outcome from making the change, lack of willingness or motivation to overcome the inertia of previous practice, and lack of policies which require implementing the guidelines. In other words, if they're not made to implement them, they just won't. Believe it or not, even the guidelines produced by the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, otherwise known as ACOG, are not evidence-based. According to one group of researchers, one-third of the recommendations put forth by the college in its practice bulletins are based on good and consistent scientific evidence. Another third are based on limited or inconsistent evidence. And the final third are based on consensus and opinion, which are subject to bias. As one researcher who reviewed ACOG's guidelines concluded, quote, when compared to the guidelines from the Royal College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, 28% of obstetric recommendations were the same, 56% were not comparable, and 16% were opposite, unquote. So how can we make evidence-based care standard practice? Well, if you're part of a pregnant couple, the change has to come from you, truly. Requesting evidence-based care, and questioning current practices when appropriate. You are really going to drive the change in this system. Those of us who are childbirth educators can educate couples on where the evidence can be found and how to access it. We childbirth educators cannot tell couples what to do based upon what the evidence demonstrates. Couples must decide this in consultation with their care providers. The change has to come from the pregnant couples. The research that I accessed in preparing this presentation came from a variety of highly regarded sources, including the Cochrane Collaboration, which produces reviews and meta-analyses on a variety of medical topics, articles from PubMed or PubMed Central, which is part of the National Center for Biotechnology Information, which is part of the U.S. National Library of Medicine. PubMed usually just offers summaries of the articles, whereas PubMed Central offers entirely free articles. And then I also accessed Google Scholar. It's important to note that these resources are highly regarded enough in the medical field that several national organizations produce practice guidelines based upon the data found in these resources and databases. For instance, the U.S.-based American Congress of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, or ACOG, the UK-based National Institute for Health and Care Excellence, or NICE, the UK-based Royal College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, or ARCOG, the Royal Australian and New Zealand College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, and the Society of Obstetricians and Gynecologists of Canada. I approach this presentation from the perspective of the baby. If I were the baby, what type of care does the evidence say I should want for my mom and myself throughout pregnancy, labor, and birth? It follows the chronological progression of medical care from before conception through the first days of the baby's life. At the end of each section, there are slides labeled "The Research Shows." These slides are based upon the evidence shown in the research. Each section is summed up with a slide labeled "As the Baby I Want." These slides represent my opinion based upon a review of the literature. The notes sections that were included in the original PowerPoint presentation have been covered by me in this audio presentation. As the baby, the first thing I want is for my mom to be healthy prior to conceiving me. So let's begin by talking about the development of the baby's healthy microbiome. The section that follows is a very abridged version of a longer presentation that I've created entitled "Seeding Lifelong Health: The Impact of Pregnancy, Birth, and Infant Care on the Baby's Developing Microbiome." If this section interests you, be sure to look for that presentation as well. So what exactly is our microbiome? Our microbiome is simply all of the organisms that live within and on us, including bacteria, fungi, viruses, protozoa. And they live all over our body, in our intestines, our mouth, our vagina, on our skin. And truly, we need diversity in our microbes in order to be able to fight pathogens and stave off disease. So they're really integral to our lifelong health. And there are certain things that can have a negative impact on our microbiome. Those include antibiotics and antimicrobial products. And our lifestyle and diet has really started affecting our microbiomes globally as well, because we've lost a lot of our microbes due to changes in our diets and the widespread use of antibiotics. So in response to this, in 2007, the National Institutes of Health launched the Human Microbiome Project in order to study how microbiomes may lead to various non-communicable diseases and what impact on our lifelong health our microbiomes and the changes in our microbes might be having on our lifelong health. Several non-communicable diseases, in fact, have been associated with the poorly developed microbiome, such as allergies, asthma, celiac disease, irritable bowel syndrome, diabetes, eczema, mental health issues, perhaps even including autism spectrum disorder, necrotic enterocolitis in newborns, and obesity as well. So the answer to why does the baby's developing microbiome matter is that we're laying the groundwork for the lifelong health of our children through the way in which we prepare our bodies for conception, care for our bodies during pregnancy, and birth our babies. This slide shows a visual model of the development of the healthy microbiome, showing that vaginal birth followed by skin-to-skin contact with the mother followed by breastfeeding is what really helps set the baby's healthy microbiome in process. If you're interested in learning more about the microbiome, there's lots of information out there. The American Microbiome Institute has a wealth of information, as does Gut Microbiota World Watch, which is a European group. There's an entire journal devoted to the microbiome called Microbiome, and of course, there's the NIH Human Microbiome Project. Those links are listed here for your benefit. Also, as I mentioned previously, I've created a much more thorough overview of the baby's developing microbiome in a separate presentation entitled "Seeding Lifelong Health: The Impact of Pregnancy, Birth, and Infant Care on the Baby's Developing Microbiome," so be sure to look for that. So the research shows very clearly that we need diversity in our microbes in order to fight pathogens and stave off disease. These microbes are integral to our immune and metabolic health. In addition, the research shows that human microbial colonization begins in utero and develops in a non-random way. In other words, the baby inherits its microbiome from its mother. And this seeding of microbiota that the baby receives from his or her mother trains the baby's immune system. This happens prior to birth, in utero, at birth, and immediately following birth. There's no do-over for this important seeding event. Furthermore, the research shows that the fetal immune system depends on adequate maternal nutrition. The mother's intake of the micronutrients folate, iodine, and vitamin D, and the fatty acid DHA, is especially important. An unbalanced microbiome has been associated with several health challenges, including asthma, eczema, diabetes, and obesity. The greatest challenges to the healthy development of the baby's microbiome are cesarean delivery, antibiotic exposure before, during, or after birth, and formula feeding. Therefore, the most important steps that can be taken to ensure the proper seeding of the baby are Step 1, vaginal birth. Step 2, immediate skin-to-skin contact with the mother following birth. And Step 3, exclusive breastfeeding, preferably for at least 6 months. If I were the baby who wanted to be conceived, what would I want in terms of the development of my healthy microbiome? Well, I would want my mom to be of healthy weight, with a good healthy microbiome herself prior to conception. One research study found that maternal obesity led to, quote, significant effects on the composition of the gut microbiome of offspring, unquote, especially among those of higher socioeconomic status. I would want her vaginal microbiome rich in lactobacilli, which is typically found in normal healthy pregnancies. I would want my mom following good nutritional guidelines, eating fermented foods and those with live cultures that are especially good for gut health. I would want her following the micronutrient and fatty acid recommendations. I would want her exercising regularly, being a non-smoker, and having low stress levels. In fact, in one study, infants whose mothers were anxious in pregnancy, based upon self-report and clinical evaluations, exhibited poorer adaptive immune response at 6 months of age. Essentially, I want my mom to be healthy in mind, body, and spirit, creating a welcoming environment for me in which I can be conceived. Now that we have a good understanding of how the baby's healthy microbiome develops, conception occurs. Now that conception has occurred, the pregnant mom will need to make one of the most important decisions that she'll make throughout her entire pregnancy, and that's the selection of her care provider. What I tell all of the moms in my classes is, you are the hiring manager for your birth. If you want or need a cesarean, you should not hire a midwife. If you want a completely natural birth, you should not hire an OBGYN who has a 35 to 40% C-section rate. This is one of the most important decisions you will make about your birth. The example I always use is as follows. Imagine that you are the hiring manager within your organization, and somebody comes in to interview with you for a job, and they say, I am very well respected by my peers, I'm highly educated, I have years of experience, but I don't agree with the mission of your organization. Would you hire that person? No, none of us would hire that person. You need to hire a care provider whose philosophy and approach match your own. I really love this quote, and it really informed my own decision-making about care provider selection for my own births. Quote, having a highly trained obstetrical surgeon attend a normal birth is analogous to having a pediatric surgeon babysit a healthy 2-year-old, unquote. Which types of care providers do most pregnant moms select? Well, in the U.S.-based Listening to Mothers 3 survey from 2013, 78% reported using an OBGYN, 9% reported using a family physician, 8% reported using a midwife, and 5% reported using another type of care provider. Since so many people are so familiar with the standard OB model of birthing, I'll focus on some of the other care provider selections. Midwives, for instance, recognize the woman as a unique individual in the context of her family and community, and they support and protect the normal physiologic process of labor and birth. They also establish the woman as an active partner in her own care. This quote from the American College of Nurse Midwives is very important. Quote, midwives emphasize helping women make changes conducive to healthy pregnancies, infants, and families. Midwifery practice focuses on what is normal, with careful attention to recognizing and managing deviations from normal. All healthcare providers involved in birth can provide care within the midwifery model, unquote. In other words, not just midwives can provide the midwifery model of care. All care providers can provide the midwifery model of care. This quote just makes me happy. It's come to be known as the joint statement of practice relations between OBGYNs and midwives, and it reads, quote, the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, the college, and the American College of Nurse Midwives, ACNM, affirm our shared goal of safe women's health care in the United States through the promotion of evidence-based models provided by obstetrician-gynecologists, OBGYNs, certified nurse midwives, CNMs, and certified midwives, CMs. The college and ACNM believe healthcare is most effective when it occurs in a system that facilitates communication across care settings and among providers. Unquote. Let's take a look now at doula care. What is a doula? A doula is a trained and experienced professional who provides continuous physical, emotional, and informational support to the mother before, during, and just after birth. That's the definition of a birth doula. There are also postpartum doulas, which I don't cover here, but they will come to your house postpartum and help you with your transition into parenthood. Birth doulas mother the mother by assisting the parents in preparing their birth plan, staying with the mother throughout labor, providing emotional support and physical comfort measures throughout labor, assisting the parents in making important decisions about their care throughout labor and facilitating those discussions with their care providers, and providing support and breaks to the birth companion throughout labor. I had to laugh when researching this presentation because I came across an article from 2003 entitled Doula, a New Concept in Obstetrics. And the reason it made me laugh is because the function that doulas provide during childbirth is much older than modern-day obstetrics, so I just thought it was funny that the authors decided that this was a new concept when really doulas have been around since the beginning of time. This is how women birthed, is that they helped one another with their births. Now that we know what midwives and doulas do, what does the research show about the care that they provide? Researchers have found that women who receive care from CNMs, or certified nurse midwives, were more likely than those attended by physicians to have received prenatal education and health promotion information, as well as fewer technological interventions. They also experienced lower rates of labor induction and augmentation, lower use of regional anesthesia, lower than the national average rate for episiotomy, and fewer instrumental births. In addition, women who received care from certified nurse midwives were more likely to experience significant reduction in the incidence of third and fourth degree perineal tears, fewer preterm births and fewer babies with low birth weight or hypothermia, lower rates of cesarean birth, lower infant mortality rates, and higher rates of breastfeeding, all at a lower cost and with higher reported maternal satisfaction. The lower costs were due to fewer interventions and lower C-section rates than those women who used OBs. These positive findings for midwifery-led care were confirmed by a 2015 Cochrane review of midwife-led care. As far as doula care is concerned, a 2013 meta-analysis found that continuous labor support from a doula led to 31% decrease in the use of Pitocin, 28% decrease in the risk of a cesarean, a 12% increase in the likelihood of a spontaneous vaginal birth, a 9% decrease in the use of any medications for pain relief, a 14% decrease in the risk of newborns being admitted to the special care nursery, and a 34% decrease in the risk of being dissatisfied with the birth experience. The authors concluded that, quote, all women should have continuous support during labor, unquote. It's interesting to note that one study found that new mothers expected their labor and delivery nurse to spend 53% of his or her time offering support, but only 6 to 10% of the nurse's time was actually spent in labor support activities. So doulas provide an invaluable service during labor and birth. Based upon these data, as the baby who has been conceived, I want my mom to hire a midwife for prenatal labor and delivery care. And I want my mom to hire a doula to work with her throughout pregnancy and to attend her during labor. Now that we've talked about care provider selection, let's talk about birthing location selection, because these two are really intertwined. If you want to have a hospital birth, you're not going to select a home birth midwife as your care provider. If you want to have a home birth, you're not going to select an OB as your care provider, because providers tend to have privileges in certain locations. So you may want to decide whether to select your care provider or your birthing location first. Of course, if you have an existing relationship with your care provider and you really like your care provider, that may sway you to change your birthing location decision. In 2009, 7.6% of all hospital costs were attributable to maternity and newborn care, totaling over $27 billion. Maternity and newborn care was the top expenditure category, in fact, for payments made by both public payers and private health insurance companies to hospitals. Maternity and newborn care, in other words, is big money for hospitals. Let's take a closer look then at the cost of maternity care. For the purposes of this slide, maternity care includes prenatal, labor and delivery, and postpartum care. And you can see here that for commercial payers, the average cost of a cesarean section birth is $27,866. In comparison, the average cost of a vaginal birth is $18,329. So C-sections are 52% more expensive. That percentage difference holds for Medicaid payments as well. Cesarean sections paid for by Medicaid averaged $13,590, compared with vaginal Medicaid births, which averaged $9,131. So you can see that Medicaid-covered births are less expensive overall, but C-sections are still 49% more expensive than vaginal births when paid for by Medicaid. We'll talk about in-hospital birthing centers, freestanding birth centers, and home births. In-hospital birthing centers are often staffed by midwives. They may offer care throughout pregnancy and birth, or perhaps only during labor. And they tend to feature specially designed rooms that are more bedroom-like with good ambiance. When compared to standard hospital rooms, the alternative setting increased the likelihood of no intrapartum analgesia or anesthesia, spontaneous vaginal birth, breastfeeding at 6 to 8 weeks, and positive views of care received, in other words, high maternal satisfaction. Freestanding birth centers are defined as a home-like setting where care providers, usually midwives, provide family-centered care to healthy pregnant women. They tend to subscribe to the wellness model of birth, using interventions only when medically necessary, and they are integrated within the health system for safe, uninterrupted care during transfers. One study found that 80.9% of the women who gave birth in a freestanding birth center with a collaborative practice group, midwives and physicians working together, gave birth vaginally, versus 62.8% in an all-physician group. Since 1990, the 21 countries that were most successful in reducing maternal mortality rates by at least 2.5% per year also had substantial increases in births taking place in freestanding birth facilities attended by midwives. An excellent resource compiled by the Coalition for Improving Maternity Services reads like an annotated bibliography of studies reporting on birth center births and home births. Please see Sagadi and Romano, 2007, in the resources at the end of this presentation. The American Association of Birth Centers reports on data from the National Birth Center Study 2 on their website. What they found was excellent outcomes for moms, with 93% of all women having a spontaneous vaginal birth, 1% an assisted vaginal birth, and only 6% a cesarean birth, and fetal outcomes that were comparable to outcomes from other studies of low-risk women. The authors conclude that the study demonstrates the safety of birth centers and consistency in outcomes over time, despite a national maternity care environment with increasing rates of intervention. Home births were very common in the early 20th century. In the UK, for instance, 80% of women gave birth at home in the 1920s, and that number fell to 2.3% by 2011. In the U.S., 50% of women gave birth at home in 1938, dropping to 0.89% in 2012. Rates of planned home births range from 0.1% in Sweden to 20% in the Netherlands. Fortunately, we're seeing small but significant increases in the rates of home birth in the past few years, especially in developed countries. A 2014 landmark study reported on 16,924 women who planned a home birth with a midwife, and they used data from the Midwives Alliance of North American Statistics Project, otherwise known as MANA Stats. The MANA Stats registry is based upon the gold standard, the medical record, and this study was the largest analysis of home birth in the U.S. ever published. The maternal outcomes that they found were 89.1% of the mothers in this study gave birth at home, and the majority of intrapartum transfers were for failure to progress. Only 4.5% required oxytocin, versus national rates of 24% for labor induction and 16% for augmentation in term pregnancies. Only 4% used epidural analgesia versus 67% nationally. And there was only a 1.4% rate of episiotomy versus a 25% national average. They also found that 93.6% of the women in this study had spontaneous vaginal births. That's amazing. And only 1.2% had assisted vaginal births with forceps or vacuum versus a 3.5% national average. Noteworthy is that only 5.2% had cesarean births versus a 31% national average. Of the 1,054 women attempting a VBAC, 87% were successful, and there was a low rate of postpartum maternal transfer. As far as infant outcomes are concerned, among these women who planned a home birth with a midwife, their babies were at very low risk for being born prematurely with a rate of 2.5%, being born too small with a rate of less than 1%. In fact, the babies weighed an average of 8 pounds at birth. The babies were at very low risk for having a low 5-minute Apgar score. Only 1.5% had that. And the babies were at low risk for requiring a transfer to a hospital after being born at home. Only 1% of babies experienced that. 98% of the infants were being breastfed, and the majority, 86%, were being exclusively breastfed at 6 weeks of age. In fact, excluding lethal anomalies, intrapartum, early neonatal, and late neonatal mortality rates were similar to the rates found in other studies and in national data. When selecting a birthing location, let's remember the microbiome. When the baby is born, he or she is seeded with mom's microbes and the microbes in his or her environment. As we discussed earlier in this presentation, the foundation for baby's long-term health is laid at this time. We have no research to inform what impact different birthing environments may have on the baby's microbiome. However, being in one's home environment may support this seeding process, exposing baby only to his or her own family's microbes. In addition, babies born in a hospital or birthing center may benefit from being exposed only to those items that have been brought from home, for example, blankets and clothing, immediately following birth. So let's review what the research shows for selecting a birthing facility. First off, maternity care is incredibly profitable for hospitals. In addition, C-sections are approximately 50% more expensive than vaginal births. Indeed, the move from home to hospital birth has really led to a greater use of technology and a loss of autonomy for midwives. Health systems where midwives do not practice have been found to have higher rates of interventions, inequalities in care provision and outcomes, and higher elective cesarean rates. Strong evidence, in fact, shows that hospital policies for laboring women, for instance, electronic fetal monitoring, IV fluids, no food or drink, restriction to bed, artificial induction, these hospital policies do no good and may indeed cause harm. The research shows that in-hospital birth centers are associated with lower rates of medical interventions during labor and birth, and higher levels of maternal satisfaction without increasing risk to mothers or babies. Freestanding birth centers lead to excellent outcomes for mothers, with a C-section rate 4 times lower than what is seen in the general low-risk population of pregnant women in America. And they lead to excellent outcomes for babies, all at a large cost savings to the health system. Regarding home births, a 2012 Cochrane review found no strong evidence to favor either a planned hospital-based birth or a planned home birth for low-risk women. Maternal outcomes related to planned birth at home have been consistently positive, and this was recently confirmed through the landmark 2014 MANA Stats Home Birth Study, as well as through a 2015 review of the literature. Most investigations of planned home birth versus hospital birth have found no difference in intrapartum fetal deaths, neonatal deaths, low APGAR scores, or admission to the neonatal intensive care unit. In the 2014 home birth study, babies were at very low risk for being born prematurely, being born too small, having a low 5-minute APGAR score, or requiring transfer to a hospital after being born at home. In addition, infant mortality rates were similar to the rates found in other studies and in national data. However, in the 2014 home birth study, more first-time moms had to transfer, and more postpartum hemorrhages were experienced than in national studies, even though only 1% had to transfer as a result of this. Also, breech babies were at 12 times higher risk of death during labor than babies born in a vertex position. To summarize, research shows that planned home birth is a safe option for low-risk women, especially for those who have given birth vaginally previously. And yet, planned home birth is best supported in an environment where good risk selection criteria are in place, there is an adequate transportation infrastructure for transfers, and a good referral system is in place. Therefore, as the baby in my mom's womb, I would like her to seek midwifery-led care, whether in a hospital-based birthing center or elsewhere, and I would like her to consider a birthing center birth or a planned home birth following a discussion of the risks with her care provider. And here we have mom getting bigger as I, the baby, gestate. Let's talk now about estimated due dates, or as I like to call them, a setup for anxiety. Due dates are typically calculated as 280 days, which is 40 weeks or 10 lunar months, from the first day of the last menstrual period. As a shortcut, you can add 7 days to the first day of the last menstrual period and count forward 9 months, or you can count back 3 months and add 1 year. This calculation is known as Nagle's rule, which assumes a typical 28-day cycle. None of the professors who originally wrote in the 18th and 19th centuries about how to calculate due dates ever specified whether the counting should begin with the first day of the woman's last menstrual period or the last day of the woman's last menstrual period. In fact, only 3.6% of deliveries take place on the estimated due date when relying on LMP, or last menstrual period, dating. Early ultrasound increases that slightly to 4.3% up to 5% of births occurring on the estimated due date. Two-thirds of births occur within 7 days of the estimated due date, with no meaningful differences in the estimated dates based upon the timing of the ultrasound scans. Several researchers have found that ultrasound estimation of gestational age predicts the expected date of delivery to be 3 days later than relying on Nagle's rule would suggest. Ultrasound is most accurate during weeks 11 to 14, with accuracy declining sharply after 20 weeks of gestation. ACOG states, in fact, that, quote, high-quality ultrasound measurement of the embryo or fetus in the first trimester is the most accurate method to establish or confirm gestational age, unquote. And, quote, subsequent changes to the estimated due date should be reserved for rare circumstances, unquote. To summarize, the research shows that estimated due dates are not particularly accurate, and that third trimester ultrasounds are not as accurate as earlier ultrasounds or the LMP in determining due date. Researchers have suggested various alternative dating systems. For instance, based upon a retrospective population-based study in Sweden, researchers have suggested adding 10 days to the first day of the LMP to better fit the data from ultrasound dating, basal body temperature dating, and the modal duration of pregnancy. Other researchers have suggested offering women a range of time during which they are likely to give birth. About 50% of first-time moms will give birth by 40 weeks and 5 days. For experienced moms, 50% will have given birth by 40 weeks and 3 days. A group of Canadian researchers have introduced a new maternity care calendar wheel, which is designed to reflect, quote, the biological realities of pregnancy, unquote, and which includes prompts for prenatal education and antenatal care. Another group of researchers concluded, quote, much anxiety would be alleviated if a range of dates from 38 to 42 weeks was substituted for a specific date of delivery, unquote. Therefore, as the baby, I want for my mom to be provided with a range of dates during which she is likely to give birth, to be based upon my mom's LMP, and possibly one early ultrasound completed between 11 to 14 weeks of gestation. In addition, I would like for me and my mom to be treated with patience and expectant management in the absence of any special circumstances.